This is EU to Go Special Towards Enlargement, a podcast miniseries exploring the EU accession process in the Western Balkans and the lessons for EU enlargement policy. In October 2023, the Financial Times reported on a leaked paper from the European Council showing an exuberant price tag attached to the next round of enlargement of the EU. This report came out over a month before the Council was due to vote on whether to open EU accession talks with Ukraine. It estimated that Ukraine alone would receive 186 billion euros over 7 years in cohesion, cultural, and other EU funds. It warned that the current net beneficiary EU member states would have to become net contributors to cover the bill. Could the costs be that high? What is really at stake in the EU with the next enlargement? My name is Besa Shahini. I'm a policy fellow at the Jacques Delors Center at the Hertie School in Berlin, recipient of the Henrik Enderlein Fellowship. Here to discuss with me today are Johannes Lindner and Tu Nguyen, co-director and deputy director at the Jacques Delors Center. Tu, Johannes, thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Besa. Thank you for having us.
Hello.
You have recently co-written a paper looking into the cost of EU enlargement, and you come up with totally different numbers, much lower than those circulating back in the fall of 2023. Where is this difference coming from?
The key difference between our paper and the leaked paper and leaked numbers relates to the application of certain caps and adjustment mechanisms that are inherent in the current rules applied to the EU budget. And if you apply these rules, it shows that the impact is lower than the ballpark figure that was leaked to the Financial Times. So we assume, based on our scenario, an annual figure of 19 billion euros per year. And we do apply the adjustment mechanisms that we know from previous enlargements. But maybe it's worth taking a step back and understand a bit what are the two key fields of payments or expenditure policies that make out the EU budget. And that's one, common agricultural policy, so expenditure that goes to farmers and farms. And then second, it's cohesion policy. So this goes to member states and regions to finance the catching up. There's a third part, which is policies of common interest, in particular investment. But these two big parts make most of the EU budget. And they are grown over time since the inception of the EU budget.
I want to get into more detail on both of these, just to go back to the numbers. So 19 billion a year for the entire candidate country group, not just for Ukraine. So the difference is also in this, that the leaked paper showed 186 billion, the cost only for Ukraine over 7 years. But what you have calculated is that the entire enlargement wave, should it be a wave, would cost much less. And it would actually be covered by the budget in the way it is now. It could be covered. Is that right? Did I understand it correctly?
Correctly. So we would assume, and these are now annual figures that you would need to multiply by 7 if you want to have the full period of the multi-annual financial framework, which, by the way, also for our listeners, is the sort of framework under which a lot of the budget discussions are held, namely a plan that structures the annual budgets into a sort of 7-year period and that gives the main ceilings and distribution along a 7-year period. And this framework is then negotiated every 7 years. And then that's the sort of framework under which then the distribution of money is then confirmed annually. But going back to your question, so from our scenario, and as I said, applying certain adjustment mechanisms, we would have for Ukraine alone a figure of 13.2 billion per year. And then for the Western Balkans and the other enlargement countries, so plus Moldavia.
And minus Turkey.
We're not taking into account Turkey, Georgia, or Kosovo.
Right.
So that's important to keep in mind. But that would add another 5.8 billion, coming to an overall figure of 19 billion per year. And with that, you would say within the existing GNI own resources ceiling of 1.4%. So GNI means gross national income.
Perhaps to just very quickly add on the difference. So if you divide the number that you have mentioned, BESA, 186 billion over 7 years, that is about 26 billion a year for Ukraine. So our calculations are really half of what the European Council Secretariat has calculated, quite a difference.
Right. So is it actually possible to make clear predictions already? Or is it all a result of negotiations that must happen on the next budget?
The existing adjustment mechanisms that I mentioned, which sort of cap some of the money that new member states would get, and which do include a differentiation between existing member states and new member states, that is always the product of negotiations. And so in terms of the sort of warning we clearly say in the paper is that on the one hand, these numbers that are floating are probably too high because they don't take into account these adjustment mechanisms that exist. But the other message we clearly say is that it's usually the results of negotiations. And actually in previous rounds of enlargement, we've seen that these adjustment mechanisms and the eligibility to certain policies are negotiated. Often, in fact, the bargaining power of the sort of existing member states is slightly higher than the bargaining power of the new member states. But to do firm predictions will be very difficult, impossible, in fact. And we are making a warning to say, look, you need to take into account the dynamics around the negotiations.
Right. So these adjustment mechanisms, let's take into account that we are applying the current adjustment mechanisms. What are they?
So they are an upper limit of 2.3 GNI that you can receive on cohesion money. So in terms of catch-up that the member states and the regions would get, it's capped, in fact, also linked to the notion that you need some sort of absorption capacity to take in the money. And so in that respect, there is a sort of limit to what could be transferred into the new member states. That's one. There is, in fact, also a rule of how much you can take away of the current beneficiaries from cohesion policy. That's 24% of reduction that can be done to the existing beneficiaries. That in a way protects a bit the incumbent member states. There's also a natural adjustment because now with Western Balkans, Moldavia and Ukraine, you would have actually poor new member states. So it was also reduce the overall level of GDP in the union. So some regions would actually lose eligibility because they would be above the 90% of the average GDP that is usually signifying eligibility to certain expenditure from the budget. So these are two. Then there's another big bulk that we are not looking into so much, but which in fact means that maybe our numbers could even be seen as higher than potentially the actual figure would be, which is the whole question on how you adjust this common agricultural policy. Because when we look at the large enlargement rounds, you have had gradual adjustment of eligibility for farms and farmers. So starting with 40% and then only going up over a period of 10 years until full eligibility for common agricultural policy spending was achieved.
To understand it concretely, for a country like Hungary, for example, or Poland, when they've joined the EU, they only got a fraction of what they could get in EU assistance, right? So 40% of agricultural funds on the first year and then gradually increasing to 100% only 10 years later. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
But to be honest, it's not only a process whereby you protect in a way the interest of the incumbents, but it's also a process of bringing in relatively poor new member states into a catching up onto an average and a level that is much higher than them. So just assume a Polish farmer that would have gotten immediately the full eligible amount, it would have also just created quite a disimbalance between other workers and citizens in that part of the union, so to say. You see, I mean, there's also a bit of a question of how you kind of gradually bring on the economies into the union. And of course, the specificity of the common agricultural policy is that we've completely Europeanized or largely Europeanized that policy field, while in others we don't, where other welfare and support still depends very much on the national budget.
If in your paper you argue that enlargement is financially doable, you still call for a reform of the EU budget. How does the accession fit into the wider debate on a new fiscal architecture in the EU?
Yeah, no, that's a very, very important point, because what we are saying, and I mean, Tu and I, we've discussed it a lot because she was part of the 12 experts Franco-German group on institution reform, is that both sides have to reform themselves, the EU as well as the new member states. And what is very clear is that the pressure to reform the EU budget is there on top of the enlargement. So enlargement is one important factor to reform the EU budget, but it's certainly not the only. And I think the sort of three main reasons for that is that we will have a new expenditure, which is related to the fact that the EU has taken on new debt to finance the recovery and resilience facility and the next generation EU. So the EU has gone to the capital markets to take on debt. Now it has started to ready to pay the interest payments for that debt, but it has not started to repay back the debt. Now, this repayment of the principal amounts that has been taken from the capital markets needs to start now with the new financial framework. From 2028, they need to pay back the debt. So that's a first factor that has to be taken in when looking at the new budget. So there's a new kind of expenditure line that needs to be satisfied, which, of course, disrupts the current distributive order. And linked to that is another point that currently quite a number of member states have profited rather significantly from actually the new expenditure that came from that the debt that the union took, which is the, as I already mentioned, the recovery and resilience facility. And that supported in particular countries like Spain and Italy, not only with loans, but with grants. That expenditure, that new money will end in 2026. So you have some elements of money that came out in the context of the recovery after COVID that will be terminated, and you have to repay that. So that is an additional pressure. And also with the fact that actually some member states have actually gotten used to more support from the EU level. And some of the money that went actually into climate and digital transformation is some of the areas that we would want to focus on a bit more. So there are new priorities in a way that the union faces, in particular climate change, where you wonder whether still cohesion and common agricultural policy are the key priorities that the EU budget should focus on, and whether there are not other elements like the transition, the green transition, but also competitiveness and the digital transition that we should look more into. And on top of that, and that's a new priority, we are in a world where, of course, the security concerns are very much on top of the policy agenda. I mean, part of the conversation we have now is the conversation about how to make Europe safer and to do enlargement in order to address some of the real threats that we see Europe is facing. So again, the priority of defense and security is quite high. So all of these new priorities and a very small budget, and you need to pay back the debt. So it's quite some pressure onto the EU budget, and that needs to be satisfied and negotiated within the next years, because come 2028, we want to have, I already mentioned, a seven-year deal that is preparing the union for enlargement, but also the future.
If I may add what we are also seeing currently, I mean, what we are saying in the paper is that the cost might be manageable, but we are already seeing the conflicts that surround the common agricultural policy and the possible impact that will have on farmers. So I think the question is also, how can we sort of manage the next budget in a way that would also alleviate the conflicts that are already emerging at this point with Ukraine? And we've seen many protests in Poland and Germany and France when it comes to grain and imports. So I think it's also about how does that sort of feed into the bigger enlargement question and these conflicts that we're seeing surrounding certain budgetary policies of the EU.
Beyond the reform of the EU budget, Tu, you are a part of the group of 12 experts that were sort of hired by the German and the French governments to look into what kind of reforms need to happen at the EU level to prepare the union for the next wave of enlargement. What were the conclusions of your report? You published something in September 2023. It was widely reported on, but what were the main conclusions?
Let me first say that we were not quite hired by the governments. We were an independent expert group mandated or asked by the French and German Europe ministers to look into the question of how to prepare the EU institutionally for enlargement. And I think, of course, the main and perhaps most important conclusion of our work was that the EU needs to reform in order to prepare for enlargement, right? So I think that is the very basic gist of it, that the EU is institutionally not quite ready to have 37 member states. And we make suggestions on different areas. The most important one, I think, would be on the rule of law and how to better protect the principle of the rule of law. But we also look into questions of capacity to act, institutional setup or composition of the different institutions, but also the budget and broader questions of how to reform the EU procedurally.
So in the Western Balkans, your report was covered in the media a lot, but it was not debated too much because I think in that part of Europe, it felt that the report is not discussing issues pertinent to them necessarily. But there are concrete proposals that do affect what the candidate countries are able to do should this report be taken into account and applied and implemented. What are some concrete proposals that you can highlight for us?
So indeed, the report is focused more on the question of EU internal reforms than it is on the enlargement process or on the reform process in the candidate countries. Nonetheless, we do have a few recommendations that I would say might immediately concern the candidate countries. One very concrete example is perhaps the question of how to bring in more participatory democracy into EU processes and also how to already involve citizens and stakeholders from the candidate countries. So we suggest that the EU sort of introduces something similar to the Conference on the Future of Europe, but more aligned with EU decision-making processes, and that in these citizens' consultations, if you want to call it that, that already citizens from the candidate countries would participate to sort of also prepare the societies and the citizens for enlargement and already have this process of aligning the citizens of different countries before enlargement. We also suggest to introduce qualified majority voting, not only in all policy areas of the EU, but also in the accession processes, so that the different negotiation chapters that the EU negotiates with the candidate countries are closed with qualified majority voting and no longer with unanimity. So the final decision on accession would still be unanimity, but at least the progress and the processes in between, we suggest to move to QMV.
Which is very important because when it comes to the accession process, currently it's all 27 member states that have to agree to first give a country a candidacy status and then to open negotiations and then to open the first cluster of negotiations. And then there's six of them and then to close each cluster and then to finally agree on membership, which what it actually meant for the Western Balkan countries is that they have been in the process for the past 20 years without much concrete progress. And a lot of the blocking that has happened was not EU accession related. A lot of the bilateral disputes between EU member states and candidate countries had to do with issues not necessarily related to reforms. So QMV would be one way to remove some of this blocking power the sub-member states have in the intermediary steps. Is this possible? Does it require treaty change? What is the outlook for this to be adopted, really?
So indeed, for us, the rationale behind it was to make it more possible for the EU to take these decisions and to shield it from very particular national interests. And to introduce QMV in these different stages would not require treaty change. In fact, this can be done through a change of secondary legislation. So for this, we would not need to go through a reform of the treaties. But of course, in the end, the final decision on accession would still have to be taken by unanimity. And in fact, it would be a double unanimity. So it would be, of course, first the member states in Brussels and European Council would have to agree, and then there would also have to be national ratifications by the national parliaments of the accession treaties. So in the end, we would still need unanimity, but at least there would be less possibilities to veto the process until then.
Yeah, the intermediary steps, it makes sense. So in December 2023, Hungary's decision not to be present at the council vote on Ukraine's EU candidacy bid allowed Ukraine to move forward without the clear go-ahead from Hungary. I mean, could this be another way forward to overcome some of these blocking that has happened from member states?
I think this is the question that everyone asked. So what happened was that, of course, to open negotiation with a candidate country, we need unanimous decision by the member states. And in this case, as you said, Viktor Orban left the room to allow for the other member states to take this decision. whether or not we can rely on Viktor Orban to do this every single time there is a decision, I am not sure. I think this is a very speculative question. It would rely on the goodwill, as a matter of fact, of those member states that do not want to take decisions forward. And I think in a way, the decision in December to open negotiations with Ukraine was very important and very good, but it was in a way also symbolic, right? So the Hungarian leaving the room, or Viktor Orban leaving the room to allow for the decision, had very little practical impact because also of what we had just discussed. There are so many more possibilities for him to veto the entire process of Ukraine acceding and the other countries. And it also took another summit for Hungary to agree to Ukraine aid. I think that it was good that it happened, but I'm not sure that this is a process we can rely on for the future.
Right. Your proposal got in a little bit of trouble when it suggested that the EU should have varying degrees of membership. Some countries would be core members and would adhere to rules and values of the EU, and others would be more loosely associated with the Union. Am I understanding this correctly? What was this part of the proposal about?
Indeed, this part was very widely reported upon and very critically reported upon. We have a very big circle in the report that has different smaller circles in it. We do not suggest anything that is breakingly new, to be honest, because, of course, we already have the European Union. Within the EU, we have a more deeply integrated Eurozone. We suggest this sort of, we call it associate membership centered around the single market. But even that is not very new if you look to Norway or Switzerland. And then the most outer frontier is what we call European Political Community 2.0. But also that exists, right? We have the European Political Community. And I think the gist of our circle, and this is what was very much misunderstood in the debate and in the media, is that this was not so much about enlargement or accession or creating different classes of membership. But the circles really came about from our discussions of how important is the rule of law for which policy. So where do we see the rule of law frontier, and how much integration in the EU do we think can exist without enforcing the rule of law principle? And for us, we said, well, actually, the rule of law frontier, or the limits, is not so much EU membership, but integration into the EU single market. So as soon as you participate in the single market, you have to adhere to rule of law principles. And if you do not want to do that, then the only option is really this looser form of association and dialoguing, that is the EPC, the European Political Community. So our point was really to say, listen, the rule of law is very important, not just for EU membership, but even surrounding EU membership as soon as you participate in the internal market.
Right. Besides the institutional reforms, Johannes, you and I have spoken a lot outside of this room about this idea of how EU, or Europe as we know today, must change in order to be able to accommodate this next enlargement wave.
I think what is important, and to a certain extent, the debate around the EU budget, but also around the EU institutions and how they function, is also about what kind of conception we have about an enlarged union. Is it simply sort of an extension towards the south and the east, but essentially we are asking new member states to become part of the union and that's it? Or is it also part of a process where there is a reflection going on, how do we function as a union, and what will bringing in a country coming out of a war like Ukraine mean for the bigger union that we are building? And to some extent, it's useful to look back at 2004 and say, how much have we also adjusted our sort of old model of a West European integration and West European Union into something bigger? And I think the current debate on enlargement in a way shows that, and then maybe less the enlargement debate, but more the debate on how to face Russia, that this debate is shaped by the new member state, the old new member state, so to say. I mean, take the Prime Minister of Estonia, Kallas, how much she is now kind of shaping the debate on union with more of a focus on security. Also, some of the voices that we hear of other parts of Central Eastern Europe. So what I think is interesting is to what extent this is part of a debate on what a bigger Europe would look like. And certainly the shift towards defense and security is one element to this. Another question, and you touched upon this a bit in the report, is also the question of whether we will have more differentiation in such a big union. It's interesting that before every enlargement round, we've always had the prediction now there will be much more differentiation. I even remember in the 90s, after Maastricht, there was the notion. We had, of course, the differentiation into Eurozone and others, but we haven't seen that big move towards differentiation. The plea that I would see is useful is to say, okay, let's also take the enlargement, not just as a sort of an extension of the existing, but also as a point of reassessing what union we would want in a union of 30 plus 35 member states. That, of course, is not just a debate taking place in Berlin or in Brussels, but it needs to take place also in Tirana, in Kiev, with Kiev, and ideally together.
Thank you both for sharing your insights and talking to me today. This was EU2Go special towards enlargement. You can listen to this podcast on all known podcast channels. You can also find us at the Jacques Delors Center website, delorscenter.eu, or follow us on X and Instagram for more news. This podcast is produced with the support from the Stiftung Mercator.